Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. We open with the Triangulator. Meet the new Durham City Councilwoman. The Durham City Council made history last week by appointing its first Latinx member to fill a seat that opened up when Steve Shore was elected mayor. Javiera Caballero is a mother of three, a former teacher, and a program coordinator with an education consulting firm. She moved to the United States from Chile as a child and has lived in Durham since 2010. Over a plain glazed Monitz donut, she has a discerning sweet tooth after a stint as a baker. Caballero spoke with the Indy about her first city council meeting, which took place just an hour after she learned she got the job, her plans to make City Hall more inclusive, and her love of the Bull City. On her first meeting, and our first meeting, this was a little surreal. I remember getting home that night and quite frankly being like, what just happened? I did not go into that meeting expecting that I had it. I knew Pilar, Rocha Goldberg, had a very good shot at it. She definitely has a much higher profile than I did in the community. But I also knew that, I guess, the activist Latino community very verbally was supporting me. On the lack of Latinx people on Durham's elected body, I was kind of floored that there had never been any representation. The community is 25 years old. That's a generation. Our numbers are stabilizing. But when people are 14% of the community, then maybe when looking forward into public schools, it's 30. So what is that increase going to do as the generation gets older? Her hopes for the city council. This is a very progressive council, I would say almost radical city council, and I think we are at this moment where Durham has just a few years to really figure out the pattern that we are going to be. Are we going to be like so many other cities? We're in gentrification mode. Everybody knows it. But we're not at the end of it. We're in the middle of it. We still have a chance not just to make this city for the super affluent. On making City Hall more inclusive. I would actually love to have a meeting where you do simultaneous interpretation and the meeting in Spanish and it's the English speakers that have to flip and have to wait. There's power in there. There are basic things like translation and interpretation at meetings, agendas, and some outreach. Then we get into the deeper level of accessibility, which is how many people in City Hall speak Spanish. And I say Spanish because that's the largest population. I think that there would be a conversation about whether other languages are in our community. On why she loves Durham. You just meet people who are very genuine and kind and not pretentious. And I never really experienced that in other places. It's all kinds of people, all classes, all ethnicities, gay, straight. There was just this openness, and then the kids started school and made friends so easily. On creating safe space for immigrant families at Cub Boulevard Magnet Elementary School, where she serves as PTA president. Right after the election in 2016, we had just a routine PTA meeting. We were going to talk about mundane things like a cookies and cocoa event coming up in December. I approached our assistant principal and I said, we can't do that. People are terrified right now. I had already heard kids crying in school, that kids had come home crying, asking, are so-and-so's parents going to get deported? So we had this forum so that people could express their concerns. We weren't the only one. Club was first, but there was one at Riverside, one at Forest View. And what ended up happening is that DPS crafted policy about what the rules were going to be. There were several messages from our superintendent saying, "You're welcome. Please come to the schools. Do not be afraid." On joining a council that is mostly working mothers, you have four working moms under 40, and I don't think that happens very often. I find that pretty radical. Regardless of ethnicity or race, working moms get left out of many things in our society. I work for an all-woman team in my other job, and it's a very difficult, different place to work. My hope and expectation is that it's going to be a more collaborative effort. I think women approach work in that way. I know that's a stereotype, but it's always been my experience. Moving on to the next article, Farr advances. Raleigh lawyer Thomas Farr's nomination to the Eastern District Court of North Carolina moved forward last week on a party-line vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Proponents of President Trump's nomination praised the vote, and Farr's chances of being approved by the full Senate appear to be good. No date for the floor vote has been set. Meanwhile, North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis said some interesting things to McClatchy reporter Brian Murphy about the controversial nominee. Tillis said that accounts that Farr had advanced knowledge of a controversial 1990 postcard mailing by the Jesse Helms campaign were unsubstantiated and from a single source. At the same time, he criticized the campaign's tactics. What was done was despicable. Quite honestly, anyone who had anything to do with the production of that mailer shouldn't really have a job in political life today, as far as I'm concerned, and I happen to know some of those people. Murphy quoted Tillis as saying that. Who were the people that Tillis happened to know? Tillis's office did not respond to questions on Monday about their identities. Those individuals could presumably provide information about any role Farr had in the postcard campaign. As the Indy had previously reported, a former Department of Justice attorney who worked on the federal investigation says Farr was involved in planning the campaign in which postcards were mailed to primarily black voters in an effort to suppress the vote. Farr, however, says he had no prior knowledge of the postcard's content. Tillis and other Republicans praised Farr during the January 18th committee hearing. Each of the 10 Democratic committee members raised questions about his suitability, with a particularly negative assessment from Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. Gerrymandering's wild week. Last week capped off another eventful week in North Carolina's redistricting saga, and what a wild ride it's been. It started Thursday evening when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a lower court's decision that ordered the state to withdraw congressional maps found to be partisan gerrymanders. SCOTUS's decision effectively blocked the state from drawing new maps before the 2018 election, handing a win to Republicans who hold a 10-3 majority in the state's delegation. The next day, however, victory came for the Democrats. On Friday, a panel of federal judges ruled that lawmakers must adopt districts drawn by a special master in the state's upcoming legislative elections. The new plan came in response to the court's ruling last year that 28 legislative districts were unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered. Lawmakers were ordered to redraw the maps, and in August, a redistricting committee offered a new plan that was supposed to fix things. The key word there is supposed. The plaintiffs in this case were ultimately unsatisfied with the committee's redraw. In response, the court ordered an outside party known as a special master, Nathan Persicilli of Stanford University, to come up with redistricting plans for 9 new districts that the plaintiffs had challenged. Persicilli submitted his plans last month, and on Friday, the court approved his plan and ordered legislators to use the new districts in the upcoming legislative elections. The new districts are likely though not certain, to benefit Democrats, who are hoping to chip away at the Republicans' veto-proof supermajorities in the General Assembly. If Democrats are able to eke out enough wins to break a supermajority in either House or Senate, then Governor Cooper will have enough power to sustain his vetoes, and Republicans might be forced occasionally to compromise with the Democrats. Republican leaders denounced the decision and vowed to appeal. On Sunday, they filed a request to stay the court's order to use Priscilla's plan, pending an appeal to the Supreme Court. They also criticized the three-judge panel, consisting of two Obama appointees and one George W. Bush appointee, that issued last week's decision. If a power-hungry federal court can order that a California-based professor gets to usurp the North Carolina legislature's constitutional authority to draw election maps, then there is no limit to federal judicial power, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest posted on Twitter. This is nothing short of judicial tyranny. Now moving on to the news section. Careful what you wish for. Despite the hype, there's reason to be skeptical about the Triangle's Amazon bid. There's been something surreal about watching cities all over the country prostrate themselves before Amazon in hopes of landing an HQ2, the company's second headquarters, which will employ some 50,000 workers and pump $5 billion into the local economy over the next two decades. Newark has offered the internet behemoth $7 billion in incentives. Philadelphia offered as much as $2 billion over 10 years. Missouri offered in excess of $2.4 billion, which wasn't good enough. Amazon rejected bids from Kansas City and St. Louis. Other cities that have made their incentive packages public aren't far behind. For those that haven't, including North Carolina, it's difficult to imagine that figure not reaching the billions. For good reason, state and local officials see HQ2 as a game changer. It will flood the Victoria city with a well-educated workforce, expand the tech base, and in smaller or mid-sized markets, put the region on the tech world map. The company's arrival could lead to a tech cluster with far-reaching tentacles, generating as much as five other jobs for every one Amazon creates, according to the economist and author Enrico Moretti. So when news came on Thursday that Raleigh was included on Amazon's list of 20 finalists out of 238 total bids, local leaders were giddy. Clearly, this would be a big boost to our economy, and our talented workforce, high quality of life, and affordable cost of living are big magnets for any potential employer, Governor Cooper said in a statement. Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarland echoed that sentiment, saying she was excited and honored to be included among the finalists for Amazon's HQ2. For all the excitement, much remains unclear. We don't have a good sense of just what Raleigh's chances are, specifically, on whether the region's surfeit of top-shelf universities and relative affordability will overcome a deficient mass transit system, though Wake County voters did approve a $2.3 billion transportation bond in 2016. We don't know whether Amazon's decision to select three finalists from the Washington, D.C. area, where owner Jeff Bezos owns a home, and the Washington Post, is a tell or a coincidence. We don't know whether the lingering distaste over HB2 will drive Amazon to Atlanta or Denver, two cities sometimes mentioned as front runners. We don't know whether Raleigh making the cut actually means Raleigh Research Triangle Regional Partnership, the economic development group that handled the Triangle bid, submitted seven potential locations to Amazon, spanning from the heart of Raleigh to Orange and Chatham counties. Those potential locations haven't been disclosed, though Raleigh developer John Kane has said that he pitched a prime corridor, get it, stretching from the Warehouse District to North Hills. When Amazon called RTRP last week to confirm that Raleigh had made the cut, That was pretty much the extent of the communication, Executive Director Ryan Combs told the Indy Friday. We're still trying to identify the site they want. On Monday, Jeff Durham, the president and CEO of the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, wrote in an email to Durham officials that Amazon had confirmed what we had anticipated, and it was in fact the entire region, including Durham, that was selected to advance. In any event, local leaders are in what Combs describes as a holding pattern, waiting to hear from Amazon about what the next steps are. Chief among those next steps will be a cobbling together an incentive package, perhaps Amazon's top criterion in its decision-making process. RTRP has said that North Carolina didn't include all of tax breaks and other incentives in its initial bid, which is not public record. In November, the News and Observer reported the Durham City and Council officials had discussed an incentive package worth as much as $50 million. Wake County has a standard economic development package and an additional headquarters package that Amazon would qualify for, and county and economic officials have been meeting behind closed doors to discuss other goodies they could throw into the company. Commissioner Matt Calabria said to the Indy, that these meetings have happened in closed sessions, which means he can't talk about them. We're going to look at this with open eyes, Calabria said. The nice thing about Wake County is that we don't have to rely on incentive packages, though I expect that to be a part of the mix. The bigger incentives will come from the state. In last year's budget, the legislature made allowances for a transformative project incentive package, which enables companies that bring more than 5,000 jobs and $4 billion in investment to the state to get up to a 100% refund on their corporate tax bill for 25 years. Those transformative projects, moreover, wouldn't be subject to the state's incentive cap. And, says John Sanders, director of the regulatory studies at the conservative John Locke Foundation, which opposes corporate incentives on the grounds that they distort the free market, this would also enable the state to help finance infrastructure to suit the company. Total it all up, and you're looking at billions of dollars paid by taxpayers to a company that could be worth $1.6 trillion in less than a decade. This wouldn't be worth it, Sanders argued. I think that incentives are not efficient, and they end up costing more than the benefits that they would bring about, he said. And Sanders adds, it's going to be brought about by crony capitalism. There are reasons for liberals to be skeptical, too. Start with the fact that CEO Jeff Bezos is no fan of labor unions or regulations, both of which, of course, bode well for North Carolina's bid. Add to it the frequent criticisms of the worker exploitation at Amazon's warehouses in the U.S. and throughout the world. Among other things, the company has been sued for not paying workers for time spent waiting in security lines before and after work, in which slim profit margins are expected by keeping labor costs low. In that sense, Amazon operates more like Walmart than Google or Facebook. Which raises the question, is that really the kind of company we want to be subsidizing? But HQ2 won't be a factory or warehouse, and it won't be filled by blue-collar people making subsistence-level wages. Rather, it will produce a surge of six-figure white-collar jobs, and this presents its own set of potential problems. Sanders points out that North Carolina's urban areas, including Raleigh, are what economists consider at full employment. Where are they going to get the workers from? He asks. If they're coming from elsewhere, meaning 50,000 well-heeled newcomers are moving to North Carolina, housing costs would go through the roof, and the newbies would strain the area's schools and roads. This has already happened in Amazon's home base of Seattle, where locals refer to the company's neighborhood, in a formerly industrial area north of downtown as Amazonia. As Amazon has grown, Seattle, the fastest growing big city in the U.S., has become increasingly awash in true traffic jams and soaring real estate prices. Seattle's median home price is $730,000, up 17% from just last year. As the Seattle Times columnist explained in a cautionary note, if there's one thing we know in Seattle, it's boom and bust. Both the rush and the relapse of the first buck are in our civic DNA. So, heads up, other North American city, Amazon is about to detonate a prosperity bomb in your town. The prosperity bomb would be particularly acute in the Triangle, according to an October analysis from the website Apartment List. Amazon's arrival would jack up rents in Raleigh more than in any other city, with HQ2 increasing rents by as much as 2%. And wherever HQ2 goes, a further onslaught of gentrification is almost certain to follow. Much of the Triangle already has an affordable housing crisis, especially in the urban cores. This would only exacerbate the problem. In October, a month after Amazon announced the bidding process for HQ2, a group of 73 community organizations across 21 states, including the North Carolina Justice Center and the North Carolina League of Conservation Voters, penned a letter to Bezos laying out some expectations of our own for Amazon. Among other things, the letter asked Amazon to eschew tax breaks, support infrastructure that works for the whole community, and make a significant annual contribution to supporting the development and preservation of affordable housing. Amazon is unlikely to forego tax breaks. Indeed, incentives will be a key aspect of its decision-making process. Similarly, whatever infrastructure is built for Amazon will primarily benefit Amazon. Already, McFarland has indicated that Wake County's transit system could be reconfigured to meet Amazon's needs. All of this isn't to say that the Triangle shouldn't pursue Amazon. There are undeniably far-reaching economic benefits if we win. But before we get swept away in Amazon fever, before we lavish a billionaire with billions of dollars, our region's leaders should be cognizant of, and I think critically aware about, what HQ2 would actually mean and how we would cope with the consequences of its arrival, which would not be insignificant. As the adage says, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. Our next news article, The Newcomers. Wake County adds 67 people a day. Here are some of their stories. Wake County adds new residents at the dizzying rate of 67 people per day, a number that often arises as people talk about the region's future. City and county leaders tout that number for what it says about the region, but it also comes with problems. Those new folks will contribute to traffic, infill, and crowded classrooms. Wake passed 1 million residents in 2014 and hasn't looked back, ranking second among large U.S. counties in the rate of growth. By July 2020, the county will be home to 1,116,912 people, according to state projections, an increase of 138,400 since 2010. That means Wake will have grown in numbers that equal the entire population of Raleigh in 1976. With all the Sturm und Drang over the influx of newcomers, we started wondering, who are these people? Why are they here? And what are they bringing with them? As it turns out, the woman next to you in the checkout line might be a novelistic essayist who moved here from Alaska, or he could be a philosopher from Rome. I hope to talk some people in to get a sense of how American society is faring and to work a lot, says Francisco De Luca, 29, who moved to Raleigh from Italy last year, with plans to launch a website that will serve as a platform for political and philosophical debates. It just so happens that I was at the time of my life when I could do what I needed to do wherever I was. Meanwhile, the millennial ordering coffee at Morning Times could be a solar energy executive who worked in the Obama administration, and the person escorting Raleigh Little Theater actors to their appearances on The State of Things at WUNC Studios in Durham might be a Fayetteville State graduate who's only been in town a few months. I like it in Raleigh, says Fidel Benton, the 26-year-old marketing manager at Raleigh Little Theater. In my job, you get to meet new people every day. It seems the region's creative energy is a big draw. I always felt like I wanted to come back to North Carolina if there was a way, says Tyler Norris, a 29-year-old who grew up near Asheville, but left the state for more than a decade for an education and renewable energy jobs. I didn't realize how much North Carolina was doing in the solar space and how successful it had been. People who move here from elsewhere in North Carolina represent the same share of newcomers, minus the babies, as international immigrants, about 20%. To get to that magic 67 figure, demographers count the 20 or more infants born in Raleigh each day. These babies are undeniably new residents, though not of their own choice. Many of them will wind up in Wake County public schools and have to be factored in when the school board and county commissioners plan for the future. New adult residents don't take long to join the voices complaining about the traffic and other issues to which they contribute. A 2016 survey that found that people generally like Raleigh also brought out complaints about traffic and growth. I think this is the hardest part of our job, says Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarland. With the numbers of people that are moving here, we're building housing, we're building businesses, we're building infrastructure. How do we accommodate all the people that are coming here and preserve this sense of place, this quality of life that we like about Raleigh? Mary Kononoff even talks like a writer. I was born in a town where they don't deliver babies anymore, she said. Kononoff, 37, a writer from Alaska, finds Wake County to be a contrast from her native state, the scene of threadbare class and crime in urban Alaska. The book, a collection of essays that reads like a compelling, finely detailed novel, is harrowing at times and lyrical at others, describing a hard-bitten urban atmosphere beset by violence and substance abuse. Living in an unincorporated area of Wake County, Kononoff was glad to discover that her neighborhood allows carefree walks with her child. I realized that I didn't need any mace, and I didn't have to worry about running into a moose, Kononoff said. Kononoff is a native of Haines, Alaska, a small town some 3,800 miles from her new home near Raleigh. Like many other newcomers, she's here because of the tech world. Her husband Peter is earning a doctoral degree in communication, rhetoric, and digital media at North Carolina State. Mary Kononoff's job entails writing proposals for clinical research, usually spending 2 days a week at home and the rest in a North Raleigh office. The couple has a son, David, 5, who has special needs. Kononoff enjoys the prosperity and safety she feels in her neighborhood off 1010 Road, where she doesn't have to worry about human or moose intruders. She's also found support services for David's behavioral issues. It's an easy life compared to where I'm from, she said. Everywhere you go, you see new buildings. Kononoff describes living a difficult life in Anchorage and moving beyond it in threadbare. I was dealing with a street killer and my brother's suicide, she said. Goodenough describes her haunting realization that Christopher Rogers was her neighbor just 3 years before he hacked his father to death with a machete, then fatally shot a college student in Anchorage. Her brother Seth, who helped raise her, killed himself during the same period. With her parents absent during much of her younger years, Goodenough was raised by her brothers in the southeastern Alaskan city of Haines, Seward, and Moose Pass until 15, when her mother returned. She went on to attend the University of Alaska, waitressing her way through undergraduate and MFA degrees. In Anchorage, she also worked as a writing teacher in a women's prison and lived among an underground of homeless people, drug dealers, and a spree killer. It's all in threadbare, sections of which mirror conditions many of North Carolina downtrodden towns. In Alaska, she also made a place among a supportive community of writers and teachers, something she's yet to accomplish in Triangle writing circles. It's another side of being new. The effort it takes to make connections is often entrenched circles of people, in the arts or elsewhere. I've been floating around, meeting groups, but they seem more into trying to publish and less about the craft, says Goodenough. It's a lot harder here to become part of the community. Fidel Benton's Raleigh workplace stands out from those of his friends in that he passes by a man-eating plant every day. That makes more sense given his job at the Raleigh Leo Theater, where preparations are underway for a production of Little Shop of Horrors, featuring the voracious carnivore Audrey II. I'm sure other people, like my peers, don't walk past something like that, says Benton, who came to Raleigh from Fayetteville 5 months ago. The Fayetteville State grad worked as a college radio DJ and did marketing work for a campus organization. As RLT's marketing manager, Benton is involved in the organization's broader picture programs as well as in its theatrical productions. The youth are exposed to the arts outside their own schools, he said. We have weekly classes. Then we offer off-site classes as well in Cary and Wake Forest and Nightingale. Those classes engender the same kind of interview and communication skills that Benton had to draw upon to get his job. They're performance-based, just to understand all those skills you acquire to get another job, he said. In January, Benton went with an RLT delegation to WUNC Studios, where they recreated part of the dialogue from the current production, What We're Up Against. The timely play focuses on a lone woman's situation in a workplace dominated by males. When he was first hired, Benton commuted from Raleigh, Fayetteville to RLT in the University Park neighborhood, but he since moved to an apartment off Glenwood Avenue near the Crabtree Mall. As for life in the state capital, he has the same grumble as countless other Triangle residents: traffic. Benton's job, like many other newcomers, combines several key areas: creative work, communications, and business. He's been impressed by RLT, both its status as a Raleigh mainstay and its work in the community. It's really a staple, not only in the arts and community, but with people in general. With the Rose Garden in the back, it's like a local trademark. Francesco De Luca had a grand vision in mind when he came to Raleigh last fall. De Luca is building a website called Zeteo, from a Greek word he translates as search, inquire, interrogate, desire to know, meditate. Designed to appear in English and Italian, the site will contain his own writings on philosophy, culture, politics, and ethics, as well as pieces from collaborators and an emphasis on providing a thoughtful platform for reader response. Sort of an untwitter, in other words. De Luca, one of the roughly 20% of post-birth newcomers who arrive from another country, came to Raleigh for several reasons. For one thing, his mother grew up on Lake Boone Trail. She was a Broughton High graduate who moved to Italy and married decades ago. Thus, DeLuca has been here several times for family visits, making the Triangle familiar territory. In addition, he was looking for feedback and support from people in the region. "The project I'm working for will hopefully be a nonprofit," he said. "I would benefit from meeting new people, although it's an early stage in the partnership. I also wanted to broaden the base of potential collaborators." DeLuca scored housing in return for a house and dog sitting in Anderson Heights, walking and riding his bike to get around. He came armed with a bachelor's degree in European literature and a master's degree in epistemology from the University of Rome, plus a second master's in global ethics and human values from King College in London. He also worked in Rome for the United Nations World Food Program. His various experiences will be reflected in Zatio, which is scheduled to appear online this summer with a subscription-based model. It will appear on a fortnightly basis and deal with issues from feminism to communications, DeLuca said. "I find the whole idea of feminism with the Southern twist very interesting." Tyler Norris grew up in rural Fairview, a community south of Asheville, and by age 25 was a special advisor to U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu. Now that the high-achieving Raleigh resident is back in North Carolina, he still makes his home to witness the progress in Fairview. "We finally have a coffee shop and a little brewery," Norris said. Living in downtown Raleigh, Norris is among the roughly 20% of Wake newcomers who come from somewhere else in North Carolina. He works as a manager of policy and market development at Cyrus Creek Renewables in Research Triangle Park, which describes itself as the largest and fastest-growing independent developer of utility-scale solar in the United States. "Everyone in the country is very mission-driven," Morris says. "The whole mission is to put as much solar as possible on the ground." Norris attended the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics, then embarked on an educational and professional ride that took him to Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Silicon Valley, and New York City, before ending up in Raleigh. "Compared to New York and D.C., it's so much more affordable," he said. "I really like it in Raleigh, being close enough to home to drive to Fairview. My folks are still there." Norris attended Johns Hopkins University for a couple of years, then took a break to work in San Francisco Bay Area think tank. He finished a degree in public policy at Stanford University, absorbing the Silicon Valley culture, which he compares to RTP. "Silicon Valley just sort of happened because of Stanford," he said. "At RTP, they were prescient at the time to see the growth of knowledge-based industries." After another think tank job, he landed in the Obama administration from 2012 to 15. "It seemed like we might have this transformational presidency," Norris said of his stints as a special assistant to Chu, and as a tech-to-market advisor in that department. Looking back, Norris believes the administration's work in reviving the tanked economy through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act is underappreciated. "Some initiatives didn't succeed," he concedes. "However, it ended up funding Tesla, which has been one of the biggest success stories, and the program's office ended up in the black." At Cypress Creek, he's part of the company's effort to support communities and utilities in their efforts to create more clean energy, including solar farms in North Carolina and beyond. "North Carolina is number two in installed solar projects," he points out. One of the many newcomers who elect to live in downtown Raleigh, Norris is witness to the growing vitality there. "I was really impressed this summer," he said. "I had a blast seeing the diversity of people who come here from all over the state." We now turn to the indie food section. In moderation, while everyone else's dry January is your lucky break. Ah, January, the month of fresh starts, freezing temperatures, and crawling out from beneath mounds of credit card debt. It's also a popular time for a whole heck of a lot of people to go dry. Maybe you've never heard of this, in which case you're likely never dependent on tips for a living. Or maybe you know it by another name. There's Sober October, which I appreciate for the rhyme, I suppose. And February is another popular month for giving things up because it's the shortest. But by and large, it's all the rage to quit drinking in January, just for the month, just to start the year off on the right foot. Some people do it to purge. Some people do it to check themselves. And some people do it to save money. Grandma always said the way you start the new year is the way you spend it. And I get behind that. But I will never begin it with a dry January. First of all, I've never been one for resolutions. Starting off a whole year with a promise I'm not likely to keep just feels like setting myself up for a failure. Hi, 2018. It's me again. Blowing it. No, thank you. Secondly, if you make your living in the service industry when everyone decides all at once to abstain from going out, it can get tricky. One friend jokes that he could take the whole month off and he'd probably make the same amount of money. When I was bartending, dry January meant scraping through the beginning of a new year on whatever I could manage to set aside during the holiday season. Everyone else deciding to suddenly become frugal created a forced frugality for me, which is fine and good, but you know, there's rent. I get it that it's important to take a break. It's important to reset. And if you know other people doing it, it can be a lot easier to join in. New year, new you. But someone out there already likes you that exists, so why do you need a totally new one? In theory, we should be focused on constant and consistent personal growth, not just setting aside our demons for one little month out of the year to prove that we can. I've seen a lot of people successfully pull off a sober January, only to hit it harder than ever once the month is up. And I'm not sure that's doing anyone any favor. We should focus less on how cutting back on drinks also cuts calories, or how to have fun on a date without booze, and talk more about why so much dialogue at the moment resolves around ways to get through a month of being sober. I know plenty of people who don't drink at all, ever, and they're loads of fun. They still go out and enjoy themselves. It turns out you don't have to drink to be an active part of a community. So, a proposal, if you will. This year, instead of cutting out drinking for a whole month and trying to spend less money by eating at home and pinching your pennies so tightly that your fingers bleed, take advantage of everyone else's resolution to do exactly the opposite. Fewer people out means shorter wait times at restaurants and bars and smaller crowds. Maybe you won't have to fight your way through waves of bodies to get a beer for once. Maybe you can finally get a dinner reservation at that place people won't shut up about. The kitchen workers are mostly likely bored, so there's a chance the food could be better than ever. I've even known some chefs to use the month to test potential menu items as specials. So go out there and get ahead in the culinary curve. While everyone else is at home and eating tubs of ice cream in their pajamas, which I promise is not nearly as fun as it sounds, you'll know be in the know. After dinner, treat yourself to a drink, or several. Have a ginger ale or a mocktail, if you're trying to break from booze. The person pouring them is probably feeling a bit lonely and will be glad for the company. And you'll probably have the entire place to yourself. If you got your own set of resolutions for the year, work them into the game plan. Do some jumping jacks. Bring a book to read. Bring a friend and have an actual conversation because it will be quiet and you'll be able to hear other people for once. Do cartwheels. Sit for 5 seconds at every single bar stool just because you can. Do you? Later snuggle up in bed, you'll rest easy from a combination of light calisthenics and knowing that a single one of those pennies you saved were planning to pinch made a difference for the people who took care of you. And hey, maybe take the opportunity to get to know your bartenders. Do you even know their names? Honestly, how long have you been going to that bar? Probably start there. Now, the best burger of your life. Hurry to Stanbury. Its elusive ribeye burger sells out nightly. The ribeye burger of Stanbury is what dreams are made of, if your dream is a perfect patty of ground ribeye topped with American cheese, lettuce, onions, pickles, and Duke's mayonnaise, which, if I'm being honest, is a dream I have at least once a week. But the burger itself can be hard to come by. I had been hearing about it for ages, but had never been able to catch at myself until a couple of weeks ago. Stanbury's menu is rooted in fresh and seasonal ingredients, so it shifts a bit, and the burger is one of those rotating players. It has also amassed a kind of cult following, so once word is out that it's on the menu for the night, the race is on to get one before they are all gone. Once I arrived shortly after 7 p.m., and the last burger was already making its way to a happy table. The restaurant opens at 5, yet this was not unusual. When it snowed last week, a picture of the ribeye burger posted to the restaurant's Instagram story was followed 2 hours later with a note written in the snow, 86 Burger, winter weather advisory, be damned. Ground in-house, the burger is grilled to toothsome perfection and served with a side of long, skinny fries. It comes as it comes. No temperature requests and no substitutions, though you can ask for things to be left off, for instance, if you are a person who doesn't love onions. But who even is that person? We are certainly not friends. I also suggest making sure you are good and hungry when you go, and order your own, regardless of whether or not you think you can finish it. You can, trust me. You'll be so disappointed if you spoiled your appetite by having a late afternoon snack, or made the mistake of, let's say, splitting one with your partner, because you will want to eat every single bite of this bad boy. The outside of the patty is crisp, and the inside hot and moist. Juicy, and Duke's ooze with each bite. Pickles, lettuce, and onions slide onto my plate. It isn't that the burger itself is overly dressed. I just can't control my mouth. It seems, once I dig in, I swipe clusters of fries through the mess I make, reluctant to miss a single morsel. When I'm finished, I lick my fingers blissfully, like I've never eaten before. My napkin sits untouched in the bar, and have somehow managed to get Duke's in my hair. I have no shame and no regrets. For your chance at this burger, you're going to have to keep an eye out via social media. Find a source on the inside, or just eat at Stanbury's every night and hope for the best. Given that they don't always post what they're serving, the latter option may be your best bet. So get there early, cross your fingers, and look at the menu or around you, because if they've got burgers that night, you can bet that people will already be eating them, and staff members who came in on their own night off will likely be among those people. If you're in luck, order immediately. Now, from the indie music section, could this be the year that a woman wins Rap Album of the Year? Rhapsody in Gold. Guided by Layla's wisdom, the Snow Hill rapper goes toe-to-toe against some of hip-hop's biggest names at the Grammys this weekend. Drum majoring her crew from the driver's seat of a tricked-out drop top, Raleigh rap icon Rhapsody practically incandesces in the video for her 2017 track, Sassy. Shifting from her more supremely composed persona as a precise rhymer, she plays a party starting big sis in a bright, black by popular demand hoodie. With her kinetic boost of energy, the coolly wiggling funk track produced by Eric G. Gabor from Jamella Records production squad, The Soul Council, glows like a neon vernacular bop. What's more, in an upset of Volvano 83 proportions, Sassy is nominated for a Best Rap Song Grammy in a group with Kendrick Lamar, JC, Cardi B, and Danger Mouse. Run the Jewels and Big Bot, her overlooked tour de force, Layla's Wisdom, is also up for Rap Album of the Year, alongside far more high-profile records by Lamar, Jay-Z, Migos, and Tyler, the creator. In fact, she's only the fifth woman to be nominated in this category. So could this be the year that a woman wins Rap Album of the Year? Yes, you heard that right. No woman in 23 years of the Rap Album of the Year category has ever won. Lauryn Hill's The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, a clear analogous to Layla's Wisdom, won Album of the Year in 1999, but was not nominated for Rap Album. Instead, it was placed in R&B. Why? For the same reason that fantasizing about murdering a woman, Eminem, had better been a winning rap Grammy about than being a woman. There are clearly some nasty viruses in the Recording Academy software, notably racism, sexism, youthism, late capitalism, and others. But this year the Academy allowed online voting and instituted a review process for rap nominations to better reflect the fullness of the genre. Those changes likely favored Rhapsody. The record industry's splintering commercial base also probably assisted, especially with a record that sold just 17,000 equivalent units thus far. Her label, the Triangle-based indie, Jamla, signing a 50-year partnership deal with Jay-Z's Roc Nation, might have tilted some scales. And the co-sign of Lamar, a 7-time Grammy winner, didn't hurt either. Both he and Rhapsody have appeared on each other's albums. But considering her career, since Cooley's Highs debut, the Summer Session EP in 2008, has been an intense tent, extended tease, and admitted grind. Shout the foot to act in day jobs. Layla's Wisdom is an artistic capstone in the purest sense. Her 8th long full-length record, including mixtapes, sprawling EPs, and proper albums in just 7 years. It both showcases and advances her skills. Still slow sales and a certain critical framing have narrow-casted it, which is nothing new for Rhapsody. On the Breakfast Club radio show, she called out an emblematic Twitter exchange where a male fan suggested that another male check out her album. The man responded, "What's she look like?" Rhapsody is highly aware, and she doesn't fit a cishet men's sexy hip-hop stereotype, and that she's often marginalized as a prescriptive woke. She knows there are those who think she's an elitist MC who only raps for other rappers, and others who see her as a woman who only raps for other women, or as a cultural gatekeeper who can't lighten up. But on Layla's Wisdom, instead of squirming against these distortions, she goes deep within, writing virtually every song as if she's telling her life story up to the moment of recording. For most, that could mean a hot, overstuffed mess. But with ingenious concision and stylistic range, Absolutely creates an album that could be described favorably, per Billboard, as tackling war, drug abuse, mass incarceration, gender dynamics, and police violence, but feels like a warm, bantering Saturday morning convo over coffee with family members, roommates, friends, or partner. For example, some might tag Sassy as the sort of fun party track that's not Rhapsody's lane. The bewitching detail is there, the Heartfelt Confessions, the Arch Work Play, the Hoops and Sneaker Humble Braga, the Simmering Offness, the Regrets. But none of it pokes out of the songs obtrusively. It's all seamlessly interwoven. Strikingly vivid and affecting, like Faith Ringwald's French Collection, her story quilts and other complex depictions of black women's yearning and struggle. It depends on what your idea of fun is, I guess, says Mentor producer Jamila Records. True, but in Sassy, the rapper also breezily reminisces about friends here and gone, tomboy truths, small-town beef, nodding to her tiny rural eastern North Carolina birthplace of Snow Hill, her departure from North Carolina State like a young Denise Hustable from the Cosby Show. Rhapsody's connection to her roots is about more than staying grounded, just like the video's reference to historically black colleges and mid-90s Atlanta, an era viewed as the black mecca of African-American cultural capital. For Rhapsody, making these connections is about survival. Some have tagged her music as retro for looking back to the other eras of hip-hop, unlike, say, the team-strilling trap-rap universe of Atlanta today. If we separate hip-hop, it hurts the culture, she told Billboard in a pre-Grammys interview. If you take it back to South Africa and apartheid and how they came and separated these people based on their languages, you can't do it by skin color because they're black, so you separate their language. So, this is the closest Lila's wisdom comes to a singular cry of triumph, a moment of sonic and lyrical arrival, where Rhapsody, metaphorically, bursts through the door announcing that she's now the star. She acts like she's been there. So what if Lamar and Jay-Z split the votes on Grammy traditionalists and Rhapsody edges them out? It's such a scenario unlikely. Well, it could happen, right? If it's almost 20 years since the miseducation of Lauryn Hill beat Madonna's Ray of Light, you don't have to be a homer to hope for another upset, especially when you hear how Miss Hill and her miseducation inspired a 15-year-old Rhapsody. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.